Issues Etc. is listener supported. That means we rely on you for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Hi, this is Todd Wilkin. Please consider making a tax-deductible gift to Issues Etc. today. You can donate online, issuesetc.org, or by check. Make your check payable to Lutheran Public Radio and send it to LPR, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Thanks for your support. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Now, we can examine evolution in all of its particular claims and parts, and we could certainly find problems and flaws therein. But is there a flaw even more fundamental, even more basic, even more elemental to evolution? Something that doesn't always go by the name of evolution, but a different name, naturalism, that doesn't even allow that particular ship to sail in the first place. In other words, is it at its very heart, this idea of evolution and naturalistic evolution, logically self-refuting? We're going to be answering that question and seeing how it's answered on this Wednesday afternoon, September the 19th, with Dr. R. Scott Smith. We're going to talk about evolution's fatal flaw. He's Associate Professor of Ethics and Christian Apologetics at Biola University in La Mirada, California. He's author of the book Naturalism and Our Knowledge of Reality. And he's also written an article in the recent Christian Research Journal titled Evolution's Achilles Heel. Dr. Smith, welcome to Issues Etc.
Well, thanks for having me, Todd.
You say that all knowledge, and this is a pretty broad claim you're making here, all knowledge falls apart on the basis of naturalistic evolution. In a nutshell, what do you mean?
Well, I think that if you look at, as I was listening to you, while I was on hold waiting for you there, I was hearing you discuss, evolution, and sometimes it goes by another name of naturalism. This idea of naturalistic evolution, in which, there is no God, at all. It's all, everything that exists is just matter. There's nothing immaterial or anything like that. I think that according to what that view of reality admits, as being real, it just doesn't have the goods to even get started in being able to have knowledge. Because things like knowledge, knowledge is always about something. Or if you have a thought, it's always of something or about something. Or an experience, like in science, we're making some observations about how some chemical's behaving in some experiment or something like that. All these things, there's this quality about these, what we often call mental states, that's called intentionality. It's just a feature of them, and it's always this ofness or aboutness. And some people have gone so far as to say that's the hallmark of the mental, something that the physical realm just can't capture that feature. Well, I've tried to take I've tried to look at all the major naturalistic philosophers out there and how they would account for this stuff, and I chose in that article to focus on Dan Dennett. And my main reason for doing it, not just because he's provocative out there now and making a lot of waves as a new atheist and all, but of all the people I read, I think he's the one who takes the theory the most seriously of all, saying, if this theory is real, if this is the way reality really is, then there really are no such things as mental entities and all. That's just how we interpret behavior. There is no real immaterial stuff, and there's no real intentionality even, this ofness or aboutness of our thoughts. In fact, there are no real thoughts or anything. It's all just physical stuff and how we think about it, how we conceive it or interpret it.
Are you saying that that if they're right, if the naturalists, the consistent naturalists, because there are an awful lot
right.
of them that aren't really consistent in this, but in right. the case of Dennett, yes, he's a consistent one. If they're consistent and they still want to tout the virtues of scientific knowledge, there isn't even science if they're right.
Science would be impossible, to do. because if my argument's right here, there's no way to even go about doing science because there would be no possibility of even having observations. You could even do experiments of something or about something or make observations of things. And knowledge is the same way. It has this strange quality. It's always about something. These features are just not, denizens are just not real. They're just ways we interpret things, just how we take things to be, certain ways. And like I tried to do in the article, if we take that kind of view seriously, and he admits, what it would take for something to really be the case that I could have a thought, that's really about, the chemical that we're observing in this experiment. If it was really the case that my, my experience was about that chemical, there would have to be an essence to that, that experience. And by an essence, he means something non-physical, some sort of nature to it, an essence. But if you're going to be a naturalist, there are no such things because those are right from those are right from a worldview that would admit immaterial kinds of things into what's real, and he can't allow that at all. So he consistently says, well, they're not real. We just take things to be these ways. We interpret them to be these ways. Well, the thing that kind of caught my attention when I read Dennett, on this, in his book, The Intentional Stance, details this, his views very well. It's an older book, but I've asked him, have you really modified your views from that? And he said, no, not really. But what he does in one place where he's talking about this, he realizes that his views have a lot of affinity with Jacques Derrida's. And that right there, set off, some interesting thoughts because I've studied, Derrida and written about postmoderns quite a bit. And Derrida's view is it's interpretation all the way down. There is no direct access to reality at all. We are just interpreting all the way. So to even have an experience requires interpretation. If you take that seriously, and like Dennett said, it's just my interpretation of things that I take it, my experiences about this or that, then really you've got this question, well, what is it that I'm interpreting? And it ends up being an interpretation of an interpretation of an interpretation without any way to get at the real thing itself or to know that you're actually having, you're matching up with anything, real at all.
Well, clear this up for me. Is it an infinite regression in the truest sense that they would say there's no there to ever get to? Or is it them saying, well, there is a there. There is a reality, but we can never get to it because of an infinite regression of layers of interpretation between us and that?
Yes, it's more the latter probably, because I don't think any of them want to deny that there's a real world. And in fact, that's one of the things I've appreciated about naturalists, because I sure believe we can know reality. I experience it, directly lots of times. In fact, right now in my office, as I'm looking around here or talking to you. But I think for them, because they have denied that there's any sort of a nature, to a thought or a nature to us, a nature to an experience such that it really could be of, this thing or about this or that, they end up with it being, well, I end up just having these interpretations. In fact, though, it gets even worse. There's another guy named Michael Tye. His name is spelled T-Y-E for anyone who wants to look him up. And in a little book called 10 Problems of Consciousness, he makes a really interesting claim. He wants to say, similar, to Dennett, that all that exists, is really just physical stuff. And as far as we're concerned, in our brains and, thoughts and all, there are no real thoughts. They are just different ways of how we conceptualize or think about a brain state. Now, if that's the case, all we've got here is just matter that we're working with. matter doesn't have any of this kind of ofness or aboutness, you know, to it. It's simply to the left of, or it's harder than, or to the right of, or spatially at a distance from. But it doesn't have any of these kinds of qualities that are needed, you know, for that are like thoughts are. One of the things I mentioned, you know, in the little essay I've got, I think that, you know, these like thoughts and beliefs and experiences we have three essential features to them that just can't be captured by anything, you know, physical. They're about something particular. You know, my thought right now is about this topic we're talking about, or while I'm here in my office, I'm able to see a water bottle here, you know, that's close to me. So my experience is about that thing. It's not about some generic something or other, you know, out there. It's about something particular. And if you have like a thought, or if you have an experience like making use of an observation, those things always seem to come about as being of or about something. In fact, I don't think we could ever have an experience where we go and make an observation about something that doesn't have that quality. I don't think we'd ever be able to do that. And furthermore, what these thoughts or experiences, for example, are about, these seem to be essential to each given, you know, like thought or experience. So if my experience of this water bottle right now couldn't be an experience of my wife, you know, for example, or an experience of watching the Super Bowl, you know, the last Super Bowl that was on. It couldn't be that and still be the thought that it is or the experience that it is. It's got a nature to it. And how do we unpack that, you know, as far as what a nature is?
Well, and let's take a break right there. When we come back, we'll get right to that question. We're talking about evolution's fatal flaw. Dr. R. Scott Smith of Biola University is our guest. We'll be right back.
The church's music from the second century.
Shepherd of tender youth, guiding in love and truth.
The sixth century. The 12th century. The 16th century. The 21st century. The best of the church's music from the past 2,000 years. LutheranPublicRadio.org.
The sharpest arrow in your apologetics quiver. You're listening to Issues Etc.
You can listen to Issues Etc. live and on demand with the new Issues Etc. iPhone and Android app. You can get these apps at our website, issuesetc.org. Give us a call, send us an email, or follow us on Facebook or Twitter. Issues Etc. in the palm of your hand. The new Issues Etc. iPhone and Android app. Download today at issuesetc.org.
There's an app for that.
Hi, this is Jonathan calling from France.
Thanks to God's gift of the Internet, people are listening to Issues Etc. around the world.
First, I would like to say thank you very much for your program. Very much ministers to those of us who are outside the comforts and the luxuries of having a confessional Lutheran congregation nearby. Thank you very much for this great resource.
Listen to what you want, when you want, wherever you are. IssuesETC.org.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. We're talking with Dr. R. Scott Clark about evolution's fatal flaw. At the very ground of evolution is this idea. Well, to put it simply, there is just matter and energy, and forming and reforming in all different configurations with no purpose, no intent, no idea, no information. None of those things exist if naturalism is true. There's no essence. There's nothing other than the things that can be observed with the five senses. And then that means, sad to say, that even our five senses, our perceptions, our experiences of these things, they don't mean anything either, because you're just a collection of bits too. You're kind of a very complex and randomly generated Rube Goldberg machine that only appears to be alive, only appears to think, and only appears to have ideas and observations. And, you know, if we go that far, we're just saying that there's no sense in talking about any of this. And yet, for some reason, the naturalist continues to talk and talk and talk about his ideas that he admits aren't real. That's what gets me here, Dr. Scott, is if you're right, and people like the naturalist that you have described, Daniel Dennett and the like, if he's right, why does he write it down? It's not real. The idea that he's having here, the insight that he's had into his philosophy, isn't an insight. And there's no sense in explaining it to us, because my thoughts on it, my reactions to it, aren't real either. They're
yeah. That's a good question. My students like to ask me that too, and I just have to kind of try to conjecture a little bit about it. And I guess maybe a couple things come to mind. One is that no one really can live this out, you know, consistently. If you really take this view and push it, you know. If you take the roof off, like Greg Kokel likes to say, and push a view to where it really goes, none of us can really live like this, you know, at all. And yet, they want to contend, you know, and show that their views are real, that there are lots of good reasons why we should believe it. We shouldn't believe that we really have souls, or that there's a God, or that there really is information in the cell, or anything like that. So they're living out and advocating, you know, their kind of view, just like any of us would want to do, but without realizing that what they admit is real undercuts their very ability to do it. So it's amazing to me, you know, in one way, you know, that happens. In another, though, it's just, I don't see anyone as really taking them to task by taking the view seriously in terms of our ability to have knowledge. And that's what I felt I needed to do by writing that book, a full-length book about this. I've seen only Dallas Willard give a hint, you know, about this problem in an essay he did called Knowledge and Naturalism. It's on his website. But nobody had really tried to examine all the different attempts by these various naturalist philosophers to see how it is we can make good on our knowledge claims. And I had this suspicion about it, so I thought I need to, you know, check out. Why would they feel a need to do it? There was a similar idea I had, and it's quickly left my mind. Maybe you'll come back here real quickly.
Well, kind of picking up on something you just said here. And I think you're right. I mean, what you've basically done is you've taken the naturalist who wants to be consistent. We'll applaud him for that. But you've pushed him all the way to the wall, and he'll deny the wall is there, but you're going to push him to the wall, and you're going to make him say what it is he really thinks is logically self-refuting as it is. But you say that there's more to this, and that is, if what they say about reality is true, then what they say is necessarily false. It's a little complicated, but can you walk us through that?
There's no way, given that there is, maybe we should just think commonsensically about it for a second. I've done an example like this with a class one time. I've just tried to kind of broach this overall topic by just pointing to some things I had in the room, and maybe I, you know, could have brought in a visual aid like a rock, let's say. And I just asked, like, okay, let's just set aside the philosophy talk for a second here. And let's just commonsensically, just tell me, you know, what you think here. I hold up the rock. Does this thing think? And that, well, you know, no, of course. You know, does this stick here, you know, does it think? Or a dry erase marker, Well, no, of course not. Then I might make it a little, what might seem a little tougher for them. And I say, well, how about a computer? And then they're not so sure. And I teach at Biola, so it's a Christian school. This is a Christian apologetics class, you know, too, so people want to learn how to defend faith. So they're, you know, they're a little more savvy about some of this stuff. But even there, I'll get, you know, people maybe not speak up quite a bit. Quite often, though, I've gotten in there people who've done quite a bit of computer programming. And I've got one time in particular, I had a guy with Microsoft in there who did a lot of programming. And his blunt answer was, no, not at all. You know, they don't do a bit of that. They don't think one bit. All they are just machines that have certain programming built into them in order to process certain inputs and then yield certain outputs. And that is it. There is no thought process going on. There is no reflection going on, really, about thoughts like we can do. If we pay attention to our thought processes, we can really make decisions even and kind of go, well, should I hold this? Why? You know, what, should I believe that? Or I can put myself in a position to have these experiences. Can a machine really do that? And his answer, blunt answer, is like, no way. But yet, on the other hand, we are very quick to, you know, we realize, well, of course we do those things, you know, all the time. So, what is it? What if we were really nothing but these physical kinds of things? And I'm trying to flesh out then reasons why we should think that there's, look, we are just matter here. And all, like Michael Tai admits going on, we are just, you know, a thought is just a different way of conceiving of the brain, a brain state in a particular configuration, you might say, or a set of neurons in a certain configuration. And we're just conceiving of them as doing such and such. Well, where on earth, you know, he's trying to keep it at just the level of matter, no real intentionality. Well, how on earth then did that conceiving get in there in the first place? You know, because that's got this kind of feature. That's a mentalistic kind of notion. And, you know, I like what he tries to say. He wants to say, well, let's think about experiences for a minute. And he says, look, I'm he admits, I can see something like a ball, a red ball out there, let's say. And I can see it directly. I'm not stuck behind all this chain of interpretations. I can just see the ball. And I like his, you know, I agree with him. I think that's true. But then he wants to go and explain, why is my thought about that thing? And he says, well, it's because, or my experience, why is it about that? Because there's a causal chain going on. Light waves, you know, bounced off the ball. They're traveling then, you know, to my retina.
About 1 minute here.
Okay.
No, go ahead. About 1 minute.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
And they cause certain chemical reactions going on and then in my optic nerve, and they cause a brain state, and they have this experience or thought going on, he says. And it's just a brain state, you know, that does all this. He thinks that's enough to account for having my experience to really be about that bottle. Problem is, there is a whole long physical chain of events in between me and that bottle. And though he claims, and others want to claim, yeah, well, my thought is just about that thing, how on earth do I know that my thought is really about that and not something else? You know, that's causing that thing. I merely take it to be about that, but there's no way I can somehow get past all these intervening physical states in the middle and somehow get at the original thing. So he wants to say intentionality, or this way I can know my thought is about something, can be reduced to just physical stuff and physical states, but it won't work. Because though there is a physical story going on there when I can see that thing, yeah, that is involved in that, but there's more going on. I also can have an experience which has a different quality than all this physical stuff. And how I can know it? Because there's something non-physical about my experience, and it can be together with that thing because there's more to it than just physical stuff too. But with a naturalist, all they're dealing with is just a whole physical story and no way to get at the, you know, the originating object, or to even, or if it's just you even deny that there is anything like this intentionality like Dennett does, then we have nothing but interpretations going on.
Dr. R. Scott Smith is Associate Professor of Ethics and Christian Apologetics at Biola University in La Mirada, California. He's author of the book Naturalism and Our Knowledge of Reality, and he's also written an article for a recent Christian research journal titled Evolution's Achilles Heel. You'll find a link to Smith's book. It's Naturalism and Our Knowledge of Reality at issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Dr. Smith, thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
Tomorrow on Issues Etc., we're going to continue our series on the historic liturgy with Pastor Will Whedon, talking about the epistle and the gospel lesson, and we'll also talk tomorrow with Dr. Reed Lessing about the Old Testament prophet Jonah. Here's what Christopher in Dyer, Indiana, posted on his Facebook page about Lutheran Public Radio, Sacred Music for the World. Meditate on the Lord's Word 24/7 with great hymnody. Do it, he said. And he posted a link on his Facebook page for Lutheran Public Radio. Now, Christopher is one of the contestants in our Facebook contest for Lutheran Public Radio. Here's how you enter. Like our Facebook page, facebook.com/Lutheran Public Radio. Invite your Facebook friends to listen to LPR, Sacred Music for the World. Send the text of your Facebook post and the number of your Facebook friends to contest@issuesetc.org, and we'll give away a 4-CD set of 45 hymns, The Heirs of the Reformation, to the contestant with the best Facebook post and the contestant with the most Facebook friends. We'll announce the winners on Monday, October the 1st. I'm Todd Wilkin. I'll talk with you tomorrow. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Lutheran Public Radio, P.O. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
Does your church need a full-time or backup organist? The virtual organist service from Church Music Solutions is genuine organ leadership using your instrument with your specific selections when you need it. You can try it out for free with our demo unit, which allows you and your members to hear and see the virtual organist without obligation and without a sales pitch. For more details, go to churchmusicsolutions.com.
We, the saints at St. Athanasius Lutheran Church, wish all lovers of the unshackled art of music unceasing grace from God our Father and our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. Since the beginning, the church has spoken by her sacred hymns. Now is your chance to contribute to the great voice of the communion of saints throughout history with the St. Ambrose Hymn Writing Contest. Render your contribution to this great corpus of song. For more information, visit clamavi.com. That's C-L-A-M-A-V-I.com.